Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
The ABBA series continues now with an interview with Hauke Vent. He's the musical director of the stadium show ABBA Mania, the biggest ABBA show in the world.
I had the privilege of quite early in my time with ABBA Mania, of meeting a lot of the people that worked with ABBA in the 1970s and 1980s. Janne told me, well, we went to all these different houses and there were musicians everywhere. They were happy experimenting themselves. They were happy to allow things to develop into something else. So that's something that we try to allow in our show as well. I did not associate that idea with ABBA because it seemed to me it was also perfected in the production. Oh, that's a very interesting question. It's a question that we spent quite some time trying to find the answer to.
Before we get to Hauke, don't forget, there are other ABBA-themed podcasts in this series. There's one with Carl Magnus Palm, who talks about how ABBA won Eurovision. There's one with Björn again. There's Jana Schaefer. Oh, there's loads more. Okay, just time to ask you to subscribe to this podcast. It allows me to grow and it allows you to find out when I've posted something new. Okay, let's get to ABBA Mania and Hauke Vent. Hauke Vent, welcome. First question, maybe a little bit silly because I know you're younger than me, but where were you on the 6th of April 1974 when ABBA won Eurovision?
I'm so sorry, Steve. First of all, thank you so much for having me. And secondly, I wasn't born then. I was born in 1975, so I've got an excuse. I didn't see it.
Okay, but we're going to talk about ABBA Mania and obviously about ABBA as well. And I'd like to start really with you and your background and what music you were brought up around.
Oh, right. Well, that's an interesting question. I actually grew up in the North with a lot of brass band music and drums and pipes music. That was where I first started before I discovered my parents' vinyl selection, and that actually included some of ABBA's records. I've been to their house more recently, and I've had a check. And apart from brass band music as well, I found those ABBA records. So I must have been exposed to their music quite early in my life, but I didn't have many memories of that. I grew up. I trained as a drummer and percussionist. I trained in classical music as well as playing pop and rock and especially grunge music. That was our time, really, the early 90s. And my all-time favorites for a long time. So different, but in a way, as far as theatrics are concerned, quite similar to ABBA, I think. And then it actually took a long time for me to really deal with ABBA. One of my backgrounds is musical theater. So I think after a long break, I was exposed to Mamma Mia, the musical, and I couldn't really relate to it that much. But going back to the originals and listening to ABBA themselves, that was then a very different story. However, quite quite a recent story, I must admit.
Just going back, though, when you were living at home, how did your parents view creativity? Were they a family that encouraged you? Or were they like my family that would say, oh, creativity, you know, why do you want to do this? Because you won't earn money.
Well, it was quite some time before I decided professional. So for that time, they were absolutely supportive. And I remember being in the house, being a drummer and percussionist means being very, very noisy. And I, for some time, practiced quite a lot. And we had band rehearsals in their cellar. So they have been very forgiving and at the same time encouraging. And we did have conversations when I said, well, I want to do this as a career, since they knew quite a lot of professional musicians and they knew how easily you can struggle surviving as a musician. But I think once they realized how serious I was, they were fully encouraging and supporting me with everything I wanted to do. So I was very lucky and blessed in that respect.
So when did your love of musicals start?
Very early on, actually. My father has been a trumpeter in a brass band in Hamburg since his own childhood. And then when I was a little boy, my parents told me, must have been around 3 years old, they took me along to some of these events where they were playing. And they just, as you do probably, they just a drum and said, sit in the corner, be quiet and have some fun. And I actually took it more seriously than they expected and than they bargained for. And then I stuck with it. And when they realized I really enjoyed this, they supported me by providing lessons and by getting me into different ensembles. So it started really early on. And I think I had my first lessons when I was 6 or 7. So I think that is for somebody going into drums and percussion. And I've been with that since, so.
One of your first roles was as Jerry Allison in the Buddy Holly story.
Yes.
Tell me about who Jerry Allison is in that story. And also, what appealed to you about being in this musical?
Yes. Well, it's quite a funny story. I had actually no real idea about musical theatre whatsoever. This is going back to 1995. I was about to graduate from my high school, and my band, my grunge band, just decided to not continue. So I was looking for somewhere to play, really. And I called up on my previous teacher and I said, I'm looking for a band. Do you have any contacts? Did you hear about anybody who might be looking for some young drummer? And he said, I haven't, but I've just started rehearsals for a show. And they are actually looking for people exactly like you, young drummers that have some sort of, well, talent, wouldn't know, but interest in potentially acting. And I said, well, I have no idea. I've never done this, but sure, I'll give it a go. And so he sent me to an audition for the show. And I remember watching it the night before I went to audition, and I had no idea what was expecting me by then. And I realized that night it's quite a big job, because Jerry Allison was the drummer of the Crickets, Buddy Holly's band. And so in the show, he was not just a drummer. He was actually playing one of Buddy Holly's best friends. It was Joe Malden, the bass player, and Jerry Allison, the drummer. They were pivotal characters in the show. So it required a lot of acting. We were on stage quite a lot. And it was a fantastic time. I got the job, God knows why, but that was life-changing for me, because that was actually at a time when I hadn't even been to college, when I hadn't really decided what I wanted to do. At that time, I was still planning to become a classical percussionist in an orchestra. And that obviously changed everything, because that really put me onto the track for musical theatre. It showed me I can actually have a career that is related to rock and pop music. And so that crossover is now something that I really enjoy. I'm okay at classical music. I'm okay with pop music, but that I do both quite okay. And so the combination is something that I find very, very interesting. And at the time, we had a fantastic time. Very quickly, I was offered half a contract. So we shared the part of Jerry Ellison. I had to play four shows a week. Fantastic. That was really a lot of fun. And actually, I got to meet Jerry Ellison in person. Him and Joe Malden came to see the show. And that was one of the most bizarre evenings, because meeting the person you portray on stage every night, that is quite something. And so we spoke to the guys afterwards and said, well, actually, you know, is what we do somehow accurate or something that reminds you of your youth? And they said, yeah, absolutely. A lot of it obviously looked slightly differently or might have happened differently. And most certainly we didn't speak German to one another, but the stories are actually accurate. And I found that so amazing to see that somebody, Buddy Holly, I hadn't really heard of before. He was not on my radar. He's not one of, well, at least at the time, he was not one of the musicians that, at least in Germany, we would really be familiar with. But having experienced that he had such a short career and so many hits, that was quite something as well.
From the perspective of a performer and a musician on stage, mm-hmm. what is the appeal of being in a musical for you?
I love theatrics in music. You know, when I said I love Queen, I think it's the dramatical developments that they manage to put into a song that sometimes doesn't stick to 4 minutes, but still a very, very limited amount of time. And I think that's one of the things I really like about ABBA's music as well, amongst other things. But there's always a storytelling element that really appeals to me. That's something I learned to enjoy with classical music. I really enjoyed being able to imagine scenes or things that might be happening whilst listening to a certain piece of music. And even if it's not program music, but it's a symphony that is not supposed to depict a certain picture. But that's something that has always appealed to me. And so musical theater seems to be one of the most direct forms of being able to combine music and literal storytelling in a much bigger picture. So that's something that I learned very on before I became involved into the creative side of things. And now on top of the music itself, it is the combination of all the different departments in a show dealing with the requirements for the light department and how you can get things really on their tracks with the sound guys and what might be interesting for the marketing people as well. So it's such a large team that has to get it right to make a show successful. And that's something I really like. You know, the team part of it is exciting. And it starts in a nutshell with, you might have a small band on stage or a small ensemble, but the team behind the scenery is so much bigger and they all have to be on the same page to make it successful. And that gets me ticking. That's really joy.
I mean, it's when you read your biography, it's quite a sort of, sounds like a meteoric rise. You know, you go from this role in Buddy Holly and then you develop into being a conductor and eventually you're a musical director. You sort of talked mm-hmm. about what a musical director does just now as well. Yeah. But I'd like to know that when you took the reins of ABBA Mania, what mm-hmm. did you specifically have to do to make yourself, immerse yourself in ABBA's history and ABBA's music? And what did you understand from that?
It was a very lucky situation for me because I had the privilege of quite early in my time with ABBA Mania of meeting a lot of the people that worked with ABBA in the 1970s and 1980s. We had a trip to Stockholm where we just managed to hook up with so many of the original teams. Musicians like Janne Schaffer, who obviously in Sweden is a legend outside his work with ABBA. and who was so generous with sharing experiences that he had and trying to make you understand what working with ABBA in the 1970s and 80s meant.
What did it mean? Tell me what he said.
Well, I think I remember distinctively that we met in the old Metronome studios in Stockholm, and he was explaining to me how thriving the music scene in Stockholm was. And I come from Hamburg. We had the Beatles here, but then it felt like a long time there was not that much of a scene. Obviously there was, but it was a lot smaller and a lot more contained than it must have been in Stockholm. But Janne told me, well, we went to all these different houses and there were musicians everywhere and they all had very different musical backgrounds. He told me how he bumped into a musician who would later become famous as Bob Marley. He met him in Stockholm and they just played music together and they all had very different musical backgrounds, but they managed to come together. This liberal approach of living in Sweden became part of how they met. And you had the jazz musicians that met the rock and roll musicians that met the reggae musicians, and it never became as isolated as it seems to be in Germany, for example, that everybody is staying with themselves. But they tried each other's music and they tried to work out what you are like in your music and how do you approach it, what is different in the way that you play. And I think that is also indicating how Swedes live. I think that is a very Swedish approach, but that was the starting point for many things. They were adventurous. They were happy to try things out, and they were happy to go off the beaten track. So that's something that Janne made clear to me from the beginning. They had obviously when they worked with ABBA, it was a luxurious situation because Björn and Benny had access to a lot of studio time, and so they managed to get a lot of musicians in the studio and just work on songs for a long time, work on grooves, work on harmonies, work on sounds. And I think they had a lot more time trying things out and experimenting than a lot of other musicians did. And so I think whilst for us now, ABBA seems to be, well, it's a benchmark in itself, but at the time when it was released, it must have been a lot more avant-garde and a lot more exciting, because I grew up with ABBA's music, but when they worked on it, obviously there was not that much of a reference to it. So that was something that I learned from Janne and other musicians, that it was experimental at the time. And of course you look at their hits now and you think, well, it's not experimental whatsoever. But it was back then, I think. And there's other musicians we met, Ulf Andersson, who unfortunately he passed last year. He was the saxophone player on many tracks that ABBA did. He told me how it was to tour live with ABBA, because Janne never toured with them, because ABBA offered him to tour with them, and he had such a big career as a solo musician in Sweden that he decided not to tour with ABBA, but Ulf did. And so he went to Australia with them for the famous concerts in Australia. And he told me how they were just trying to copy what they achieved in the studio and bring it on stage. And so it was a lot of tech. It was a lot of people at a time when that was not really the thing to do. But they really tried to recreate as much as possible the sound that ABBA created in the studio, which obviously for us now it's you know, we talk about the wall and we talk about how intricate the sound is, but they tried to recreate that on stage at a time when it was a lot more difficult for them to do than it might be for us to do that now.
You mentioned two things which are really coming to my mind from what you said. Yes. This idea, it's a collaborative thing, ABBA, definitely, and they allowed the musicians freedom to bring in ideas, which was something very interesting. And also the complexities. That's what I wanted to mention, because ABBA on first sight, first listen, to the uninitiated like myself, okay, so I'm not a musician, but I listen to ABBA and it sounds simplistic, but it's actually not. It's a very, it's their songs are very complex. So yes. To that extent, what did that experience of talking to people like Jana and going to the studio and really trying to understand how they created music and how they performed music, how did that experience allow you to feed those ideas into ABBAmania?
Oh, that's a very interesting question. It's a question that we spent quite some time trying to find the answer to.
And Hauke will reveal what the answer to that question is in just a moment. Now, don't go away. It's time for me to ask you, as usual, to please subscribe. It helps me and it allows you to find out when something's new on the podcast. Okay, let's get back to ABBAmania and Hauke Vent.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
It always needs an element of musicianship. It always needs an element of surprise, and it needs an element of we need to allow things to develop to a certain degree. And that's something that initially I found, I did not associate that idea with ABBA because it seemed to me it was also perfected in the production. But having learned that a lot of the musicianship actually happened in the studio and they just managed to brush it up that well afterwards, allowed us to realize, okay, you don't always need to, not every split second of our show needs to sound like ABBA did, because they were happy experimenting themselves. They were happy to allow things to develop into something else. So that's something that we try to allow in our show as well. We don't need people to be able to close their eyes and say, this sounds exactly like an ABBA record, because then they could just play the ABBA record. But ABBA were always trying to reinvent themselves, or at least if they weren't trying, they were allowing to reinvent themselves. And that's what we're trying to do as well. We're saying, because in recent times, obviously ABBA came out with Voyage, the show in London, where they took a very interesting approach on, well, they have aged quite a few years. They have aged 40 years since the last time we saw them on stage together. And in the show, they quote a lot of things where you realize, yeah, they obviously had to deal with the question, how do we sell that we have aged 40 years to audience that haven't really seen us in 40 years? We've seen them all individually, but not perform together as ABBA. And so we are saying, well, we're not ABBA. We don't have the four guys on stage, but it's in another way, it's a different approach because we are as young as they have been when they performed together. We can try to recreate that energy in a live show that ABBA would have done, that obviously Voyage is not. I think it's two very different concepts. And I would never say one is better than the other, but it clearly helps to have it clearly a clear differentiation between those two approaches. And having met those guys that worked with ABBA really encouraged us to go down that route and to say, yes, that they would certainly have done themselves in a similar situation to ours.
The story of ABBA itself, four main members of ABBA, let's say, without the sort of people around them, but the four main members of ABBA, is a very emotional story.
Yeah.
So what sort of journey do you take the public on through ABBA's music?
Well, you can't really help taking them on that journey, because the music and of the early ABBA years, which, you know, they were two married couples, it's got a lot of elements of love and familiarity. It's a very, very close and emotional package that they created in their music. And then if you look at the later songs, The Visitors, the album, for example, you can't fade out that there were problems on many different levels for these guys. So that's something that we by default have to address somehow, because it's very difficult to put the early songs next to the late ones and not have some sort of commentary going with it. And it's something, funny enough, that a lot of audiences don't really like, because they get so immersed in the joy of ABBA, and then when you say, well, actually this is what happened next, they're like, oh no, I don't want this to happen. Unfortunately it did. So we need to address that somehow, and we do, but we try to make it a smooth transition for them. But the music is obviously very different. It's great songs, but they have such a different feel, and you can feel that things were wrong chemistry-wise between the four of them.
I mean, you mentioned the word there, immersive, and I was going to talk about that, because musicals that I've been to, the ones that I've really liked, are immersive experience for the audience. It's like you're shutting the world outside off, and you're suddenly in another world. Is that how you see it? And how difficult is it to create an immersive experience in a theatre?
I think it's very difficult. And yes, that's what we're trying to achieve. We've got an audience who come to see the show, who want to have a good time. I think that's the common thing. Everybody wants to have a good time, because really the first thing that most people will say about ABBA's music, it's danceable, and it's upbeat and positive. And most of the songs can be that. And what we try to give the audience, we love when they dance along, and that makes it special for us as well, because then we become one unit, the artists on stage with all the tech staff around it and the audience. It ideally it becomes one unit, but it's something that is very hard to create, because you never know how the audience is going to react. And yet most of the times, well, so far, every time I've been involved, it has worked, because the audience they want to have a good time, and they know that there was an end to ABBA's live career, and we need to address that. And yes, I guess trying to be immersive is one of the keys, because we play very large arenas, and the last thing we want is that there's a large gap between what we do on stage and what the audience experience. Arenas can become very anonymous places, and we try to overcome that. We want it to be one party group really coming together.
What do you think the enduring appeal of ABBA is?
You said earlier the music, when you first hear it, sounds simple, and I think that is the most crucial part. It's music that, if you don't try to analyze it as a musician, if you just listen to it and if you enjoy it, it goes straight into your blood and quite often into your limbs when it's danceable music. If you listen to the lyrics, for example, they're very rarely they are trying to burden you with a story that is too deep and too difficult to understand. A lot of times the lyrics serve the purpose of sounding well more than telling a deep story. And that is deliberate, because they wanted the music they play to really get into your bones and to get you up and dance or to listen and have a good time. And I think that is what makes their music so successful after all these years. You can turn it on, and very often it's ABBA, so they have a very distinctive sound, but they also have a very distinctive approach to how music should feel. And that's what we're trying to capture as well, obviously, that it's the feel, the essence of the music that seems to be universal and enduring for that reason.
When you create a show like ABBAmania, what sort of rights do you have to get, and what can Benny, Bjorn, Agneta and Frida really demand of you? Can they do anything, or do you just have to get the rights? I really don't know how that works.
Luckily, the rights question is one that I don't have to deal with that much. So I can't give you a detailed answer. I know there's a lot of conversation that went into the titles of shows, because I remember there was a case in America where some tribute band called themselves ABBAmania, and they were sued by Polar Music, which is the label from Björn and Benny. Now, we don't run that risk because we're called ABBAmania the show, technically, and that seems to be different. As far as what we do in the show is concerned, luckily, whenever there's questions, that can be passed on to the legal department. But I believe as long as it's a concert situation, and clearly that's what our show does, we don't even have any scenes that we play or any theatrics in that sense. As long as we don't touch that, which we have no intention of doing, I don't think there's that much, to be honest. But I might be wrong, and there's so much more under the bonnet that I'm not aware of.
Have you actually had direct contact, or they've come to see ABBAmania, Benny, Bjorn, Annefrid and Agneta?
No, they have not. And I think that's a deliberate decision, because that might be promoting anyone who's doing some sort of ABBA tribute. And I think, as far as I'm aware, they deliberately don't go and see anything like that. They encourage it in a way, because they feel honored that people pay tribute to their work by putting on shows. And that we've heard about our show as well, because obviously there's a connection between Janne and them. Janne is, I don't know how regularly, but he is in touch with those four. So they are aware of us, and yet they would not go out and publicly say, yeah, we endorse this or something like that, which obviously that would be very lovely. And I would be ready for it, having met Jerry Allison all these years ago, but I don't think it's going to happen.
I talked to Rod from Bjorn Again, which is more of a pastiche show of ABBA songs. Obviously takes, you know, I mean, creatively and musically, it takes a lot to do that as well. And he said that he was told by Benny, or played a role really in ABBA's comeback, because at a point they were out for many years, and then in the 90s they sort of came back, but they felt they'd been forgotten. And my thing that I got from him is all these shows, and I know ABBAmania is the biggest one, in a way they are providing the longevity of ABBA. Do you feel that?
Oh, most certainly, because I mean the last time you would fall on a stage together performing was over 40 years ago. So I understand that they have no intentions of doing that again. And so we are the next best thing, I think. And as long as these tributes are dealing with ABBA and the people behind ABBA and the music with the respect that they deserve, I think that is a lovely thing to do anyway. And I think If I try to put myself into their positions, I would be happy about that too. Apart from the fact, obviously, that we need to pay royalties and all these things, and that's a bonus too. But obviously, that's not relevant to them, because I don't expect they would need that sort of money to survive.
I think they're doing pretty well on their own, aren't they? Okay, I'd like to know a couple of short questions. Have you got a favorite ABBA song?
Well, we were trained to answer with Dancing Queen, obviously. And I have to say, I'm always, when I hear that song, I'm always amazed. You always hear something else. And the moment you hear that piano gliss or some other part of the song, you're straight away, you're in a good mood and you want to dance. I think my favorite ABBA song changes with the mood, because they have got so many different moods in their songs that it's very difficult to answer that question. If you ask me right now, it's does your mother know?
Hauke Vent, I want to thank you, because I really love this idea of that a pop group can turn into so many different things over the years. And of course, yes. ABBA Mania is the biggest one of this, the stadium representation of a band that will never go on tour again. No. So it keeps that part of the memory alive. You weren't here 50 years ago on April the 6th, 1974, but you definitely will be here on April the 6th, 2024. Will Absolutely. You be watching Eurovision? And do you feel that Eurovision has a relevance today in the way that relevance 50 years ago, creating, you know, to start the worldwide creation of a band like ABBA, would ever happen again? Could this ever happen again?
I can't see that happening. I think the Eurovision has turned into something completely different. And I can't imagine that a band would found their success on winning the Eurovision as ABBA did. Although I'd love to see it. And I love the idea of the Eurovision because it brings together. And I think it might need a little bit, but the idea, I think, is fantastic.
That's brilliant. Well, I wish you continued success. Hauke Vent, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Up there is an interview I recommend. Down there is where you can find all the podcast interviews. And here is where you can connect.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.